This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My co-host Anthony Brooks is off today. Well, history-making events mark today's Week in Review. First, the Supreme Court heard two cases on gay marriage, an oral argument over the Defense of Marriage Act and California's Proposition 8.
When did it become unconstitutional to prohibit gays from marrying?
There are two kinds of marriages, the full marriage and then the sort of skim milk marriage.
And Tom Menino, Boston's longest-serving mayor, says he will not run for re-election.
I'm here with the people I love. To tell the city I love, that I will leave the job that I love.
Well, joining us now to discuss these major stories is Peter Canellos, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Peter, good to have you back.
Thanks, Meghna.
Also with us is Nancy Gertner, professor at Harvard Law School and former federal judge on the U.S. District Court of Massachusetts. Nancy Gertner, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Pleasure to have you join our Week in Review team, by the way. Well, let's start off with those two major cases argued this week before the Supreme Court, that, of course, over Prop 8 and DOMA. Here's Justice Antonin Scalia responding to lawyer Theodore Olson, the man who brought the suit against Proposition 8, on Olson's argument that marriage is a fundamental right. Here's how Antonin Scalia responded.
When did it become unconstitutional to prohibit gays from marrying?
Then they did not assign a date to a Justice Scalia, as you know. What the court decided is a case that came before.
I'm not talking about the California Supreme Court. I'm talking about your argument. You say it is now unconstitutional.
Yes.
Was it always unconstitutional?
It was constitutional when we, as a culture, determined that sexual orientation is a characteristic of individuals that they cannot control.
I see. When did that happen?
There's no specific date in time. This is an evolution.
Well, how am I supposed to know how to decide a case?
Because
then?
The case
you
that's
can't
before
give me
you,
a date when the Constitution
case that's
changes.
You today.
Well, that exchange goes on and on. But Nancy Gertner, you are a former federal judge. Let me ask you, what was your response upon hearing all of this oral argument, and help us understand where the court might be headed on these cases?
Well, it's not clear. The California case is in a sort of messy procedural situation because essentially the state government didn't want to go forward to defend Prop 8, and so it's only a question of the initiative, the petition, the people who are in favor of the petition going before the Supreme Court. I actually think the court is going to duck that, send it back in some form, which would then mean that California's gay marriage laws stand because of the breadth of the decision that Vaughn Walker did. As far as the DOMA decision, again, there's a technical standing argument, which means that the argument is that because the federal government declined to defend DOMA, even though they are enforcing it, that somehow there isn't a case or controversy. I actually think that that is a weak argument. And if I had to give a prediction, there's a funny kind of intersection between, on the one hand, the justices who believe in marriage equality and Justice Kennedy, who's a strong states' rights advocate. And so there's an argument that he seems to be interested in, a very narrow argument that says that marriage issues are issues for states to address. And that would mean that DOMA, there's no uniform federal standard with respect to marriage equality. DOMA then is overturned insofar as it imposes a uniform federal definition of marriage. It would mean then that nine states plus the District of Columbia would have gay marriage. And it might have broader implications on whether or not non-gay marriage states then have to give full faith and credit, have to recognize the marriages from marriage equality states. In those nine states.
Interesting. So, Peter, help us look a little even more broadly than that. I mean, there's a lot. Everyone's eyes are on the Supreme Court regarding these cases, no matter what they decide. I mean, what impact do you think this might have on our collective opinion about the court?
Well, I think that the exchange that you had between Ted Olson and between Justice Scalia was a very, very interesting one, because the conservative bloc of justices likes to believe the Constitution is static, that it means the same thing 100 years ago that it means today. And this is an example, as Olson was pointing out, that an example of evolving standards where people have come to a new understanding about the nature of homosexuality, but also a new appreciation of gay relationships and the right to marriage and the importance of the right to marriage. And I think it's a test of whether the Supreme Court is going to evolve with the times or not. And if it doesn't, I think it'll be a lot more pressure on the court's conservative block.
Nancy, this is one of the reasons why I was delighted that you could join us today, because I'm very curious from a judge's standpoint. I mean, for example, when the court decided in the Loving versus Virginia case that found bans on interracial marriage unconstitutional, at that time, if I remember correctly, public opinion, only 14% of America supported interracial marriage, whereas now for gay marriage in the United States, the latest polls show that, 58% of Americans support gay marriage. So, I mean, we also heard in oral argument at the court this week, especially in the Prop 8 case, that the justices were showing a little bit of discomfort in terms of, do we move faster than the country,
right.
Do we not? I mean, should that even have any place in their minds as arbiters of America's legal system?
Well, I mean, there's a doctrinal point here. And so the doctrinal point is you want the political process to go forward. There's actually an interesting footnote here, which is Justice Ginsburg has been enormously critical of Roe v. Wade. And critical of Roe v. Wade, not because of the outcome, but because essentially the court threw out not just the case in front of it, but broadly described what a constitutional abortion statute would look like. So she's a go slow person, which is the since Roe v. Wade was getting ahead of the country, and more than that was basically stopping each individual court and each legislature from addressing the issue. So she's a voice for caution under these circumstances. And I think that that's also what Justice Kennedy would likely do. If your question is, does the court pay attention to political realities in the country?
Or even should it?
Well, I think, there's always a debate as a judge between, on the one hand, being independent, life tenure, and on the other hand, being accountable. And accountable means that your decisions have to be able to be explained in a way that the public understands. And the accountability part does mean that you pay some attention to the reception that your decisions will have. Mm. It's unavoidable. I mean, Brown versus Board of Education took, a decade to enforce because of the realities of the time.
Peter, do you have a thought on that?
Well, I would be quite surprised if Justice Ginsburg votes to uphold DOMA, just because you believe that her critique of Roe v. Wade wasn't that she doesn't believe that there are abortion rights in the Constitution, but she just felt like the decision was sort of
too broad,
badly overwritten.
Yeah, no, I agree with you
in that kind of way. And so I suspect that she would be a force for moderation, but not a force for DOMA.
No, I agree with you. I didn't mean to suggest that she would be voting for DOMA, just that she would be more likely. There are two ways they can look at this. One is broad marriage equality and announce an equal protection standard under the 14th Amendment. The other way they could, or the Fifth Amendment, the other way they could do it is to talk about federalism / states' rights, which then enables the states that have had gay marriage. And that's much more likely to be the outcome for her.
Peter, I'm curious what you think about the notion that a lot of people, sort of pundits and opinionators around the country, have been saying that in a way, it doesn't really matter in the long run what the court chooses to do, because, we're seeing not all by any stretch of the imagination, but we have seen several states recently through voters saying yes, they will legalize gay marriage, that force is inevitable across the country eventually.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, when the political numbers have changed very, very dramatically. The 58% that you referenced is well above 70, and I think 80, the younger you get, it's above 70 for people in their 30s, it's above 80 for people in their 20s and things. With that level of support, the political branches themselves will install gay marriage, even if the court enforces DOMA in the near future.
Nancy Gertner, you're sort of shaking your
head?
Well,
I mean, I think that it will be the patchwork quilt that our country is. I mean, I'm not so sure that the South would... I think it'll be regional, and I think that there will be the majority of regions, but I don't see it as As a foregone conclusion, at least in certain parts of the country.
Well, on that note, again, from your perspective as a former judge, how long can the federal judicial system allow vast divergences in rights when it comes to marriage if we have, you know, blocks of the country that that remain against gay marriage?
Well, but there are lots of differences with respect to adoption rights of gay people. I mean, the issue is, if this decision is a narrow federalism decision, then it will privilege individual states going along at their own route, at their own pace. It's hard to say whether the Supreme Court will allow it. The Supreme Court is in a sort of crossroads now. It's a 5-4 tipping point, with two of the oldest judges being in the 4 group as opposed to the 5 group. So who knows what the Supreme Court would do? At least with respect to DOMA now, it's at the intersection of a conservative ideology on federalism and a more liberal ideology with respect to marriage equality.
Well, let's move on, if we can, briefly to the other historic news that came right out of Boston this week, and that is the announcement by Mayor Tom Menino that he will not seek re-election. Here he is yesterday.
I can run. I can win. And I can lead. But not in the neighborhoods all the time as I like.
So, Peter, in the Twitter sphere yesterday, some people tweeted me, I don't know, half joking or if half serious, saying that this was bigger than the Pope's retirement for Boston.
Well, I think that, you know, certainly the Menino era is going to go down as a very, you know, positive period of growth and improvement for Boston. And I think that Menino's decision not to run again, while it's the correct decision, you know, opens up a window of uncertainty about the city and its future. But it also provides an opportunity for new growth and new directions and new perspectives. I mean, after 20 years, there's a benefit to any kind of a house cleaning, any kind of a renovation that goes on, City Hall or your own home.
Nancy Gertner, your thought on this?
Well, it's interesting. I was thinking a lot about it. When I came to Boston, was right before the horrible incident when Ted Landsmark, who was a classmate of mine at Yale, was beaten up with an American flag in front of City Hall. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that...
During the busing crisis,
right. But one of the things that Mayor Menino did was, here was a politician who on first blush could have been an ethnic politician and play ethnic politics, one group against the other, instead chose to be much more of an expansive, inclusive mayor. And I was really touched by the comments of people from the Black community about his leaving. It's not easy for a mayor to be able to span the divide, the cultural and political and economic divide in a city. And he has, to some extent, done that. And what a tremendous, tremendous difference from the Landsmark episode to now.
You know, Peter, it seems to me that for quite some time, because it has been 20 years, we will be parsing what the mayor's legacy is. You know, yesterday we had a conversation on this show about how he has sort of ushered in what is now the new 21st century Boston in terms of not only the neighborhoods, but the skyline, Boston's profile nationally and internationally, et cetera. So I wonder, though, there's also the constant tension between, was he too much the urban mechanic who was worried about potholes, et cetera, and didn't have enough of a big vision? Do you think that that's a question that's going to dog him, or does it even matter?
Yeah, I'm not sure that it matters given where Boston is right now. I mean, the proof is kind of in the pudding, and I strongly agree with what Nancy said about him being a healing figure. And I think it goes even beyond race. You know, we've often had that neighborhood downtown dynamic that you know, has been a real source of division and a real source of anger in Boston, and part of the kind of groaning sense of people competing for a limited pile of spoils here and things. And Boston has really transcended that under Menino's leadership. And the worst possibility going forward would be if somehow, you know, the political system, you know, creates a dynamic that allows some of those old pathologies to take root again. So I think Menino's record has been entirely positive, and we would be lucky to have another Menino.
Right.
Well, in just a few minutes, we're going to be talking with some of the people who would love to fill his shoes. That's a little later in the program. But right now we have just enough time for our hubbubs. And Peter, why don't you start with yours?
We had a meeting today here at the Globe with folks from the Children's Museum. We had done an editorial praising their decision to allow people who are food stamp eligible, who have their electronic benefits card, to get in free to the Children's Museum. And I think it would be a great idea if other museums in the city participated in that program. Some are starting to explore it. It would be great if they all did, because people who are financially needy can't be paying the $20 that some of these museums are requesting.
Absolutely. Why not allow them to have access to the great cultural institutions around Boston?
Yes. Yeah.
So, Nancy Gertner, your hubbub.
We had a momentous, tragic, horrible loss this week with the passing of Tony Lewis. And I'm thinking about that as I was trying to think about how to talk about complex constitutional issues on your program. There was none better than Lewis to describe, to take complex facts and present them to people and to give a human dimension. He spoke to my criminal procedure class last semester about Gideon, and he was frail, but he captivated the room with his stories, both of the Supreme Court and of the man, Gideon the man. So it's a gigantic loss.
A longtime Bostonian, married to former Supreme Judicial Court Chief Justice Margaret Marshall.
Right.
Really a great loss. He transformed journalism regarding the legal profession here in the United States. So thank you for remembering Anthony Lewis on our program. My hubbub, I'm actually going to do something terrible. I'm going to tease listeners and say you're going to hear a lot more about it a little later in the show, but it has to do with today's announcement from WBUR and NPR that the two organizations are expanding Here and Now to be the premier midday news program from WBR and NPR. Lots of great, interesting things to talk about regarding that. Some people out there who are fans of Talk of the Nation, perhaps not so pleased, but we'll hear more about that a little later in the show. So a good expansion for Robin Young in Here and Now. That's my hubbub today. Well, Peter Kanellis is the editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Peter, it is so great to have you always as part of our Week in Review team. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Magna.
And Nancy Gertner, professor at Harvard Law School and former U.S. District Court of Massachusetts federal judge. So great to have you as well. Come
Thank
back
you.
Soon.
Thank you.
Well, listeners, stick with us because up next we will talk to some of those people who might have their eye on the mayor's office. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.